This is the Infotagen podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. The mission statement of the Transatlantic Commission on Election Integrity states that election interference is a major threat to the universal right of people to take part in democratic elections. Still, the democratic governments and technology companies around the world are scrambling to meet the challenges of the latest election meddling tactics and technologies. I'm Damien Collins, and in this podcast, I'll be discussing the work of the Commission to safeguard elections in the digital age with its co-chairs, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the former Prime Minister of Denmark and Secretary General of NATO, and Michael Chertoff, who was the United States Homeland Security Secretary for the second term of the presidency of George W. Bush. We'll also be hearing from our resident disinformation analyst, Dr. Charles Creel. Anders Fogh Rasmussen and Michael Chertoff, it's wonderful to have you with us on the Infotagen podcast. And I wanted to start our discussion really focusing on the work you've done in establishing the Transatlantic Commission for Election Integrity. I mean, that started in 2017, really as the world started to understand a little bit more about interference in elections. I'd be interested to know where the inspiration for the Commission came from at that time.
Yeah, the inspiration actually came from now President-elect Joe Biden. He wrote an article in the foreign policy magazine Foreign Affairs in the late autumn of 2017. He argued that the Russian meddling into the U.S. elections in 2016 was a grave threat to democracy. So he suggested to establish a 9/11-like American commission. I called him, said he was right, but I argued this is not only an American problem, but it's a transatlantic challenge. We are faced with a number of European elections, and we are also concerned about Russian meddling into those elections. He agreed. So in spring 2018, we established the Transatlantic Commission on Election Integrity. And typically for Joe Biden, he insisted that it should be bipartisan. So he suggested a shared chairmanship. So I was chairman on the European side, and on the American side, he suggested a Republican, Michael Chertoff, who is a former Homeland Secretary in the U.S. It was an excellent way of doing things, and we have done a lot of activities since we started in the spring 2018.
And was your at the start? I'm interested because of your role, not just as a former Prime Minister of Denmark, but as former Secretary General of NATO, and obviously Michael Chertoff, your experience as Homeland Security Secretary, right. Is that looking at this is not just as an information issue, but a security issue as well. That information warfare is in a way a form of cyber warfare and a threat to democracies as well as other threats exist.
I think that's true, and if you look at some of the Russian military doctrine, there's a doctrine called the Gerasimov Doctrine, named after one of their senior generals who gave a speech a few years ago, in which he made it clear that information is a domain of conflict, and that if you are able to undermine your adversary's cohesiveness and social trust, you actually undermine their unity of effort and you weaken their ability to resist other kinds of conflict. The Chinese have a similar view as well, that information is an element of conflict. So I think that we recognize, if you go back historically, that certainly in this last decade, we were slow to appreciate the way in which these kinds of tools would be used to advance a geopolitical agenda and to undermine our societies.
think that's important. And I mean, disinformation and election interference isn't necessarily a new thing. We saw it during the Cold War, particularly in Europe. But obviously, the internet and social media gives new possibilities for that can be done cheaply and easily. And how quick do you think we've been to understand the nature of that threat?
I think we've been too slow. Until 2016, we were not aware of this kind of new warfare. And we have only gradually adapted to it. So what we considered one of the first tasks of the Transatlantic Commission on Election Integrity was to raise awareness. That in itself is a very important instrument, because if the people in a country is aware of the risk of foreign meddling, then they will be more resilient. So we have made public campaigns. We have made we have organized meetings for legislators on both sides of the Atlantic. And actually, we also organized a joint session in the U.S. Congress between European and American legislators. And the outcome of that was also a declaration on certain principles. So the very first task was to raise awareness.
And I mean, I think that's what, and I sort of feel that the discussions we've had on this podcast, some people say, well, looking at the problems going into the 2020 presidential election, how much has really changed since 2016? But I think the one thing that has really changed is we're much more aware of what we should be looking for and what we should be afraid of than we were 4 years ago.
And I would say the social media companies, I think this was brought more to the forefront of their awareness, and that put pressure on them to begin to respond to what had been a deliberate effort to manipulate social media to draw kinds of messages, and particularly manipulation using false fronts or automated systems that artificially affect the ranking of particular types of stories. And so this was at least in part, I think, responsible for getting these social media companies to begin at least to remedy some of the exploitation by troll farms in St. Petersburg or botnets generated out of other parts of Russia.
And when the commission was launched, I think there was a particular focus on the elections to the European Parliament in 2019. And there was a considerable fear then that in elections that are historically quite low turnout elections, well, particularly in the UK, that it's quite easy to interfere in an election like that, and there was a big concern of Russian interference. I mean, Anders, looking from the European side, I mean, do you think enough was done in advance of those elections to prepare for that threat? And is what happened what you expected would happen?
Yes, we saw clearly Russian attempts to meddle in the elections. I don't think the European Parliament had devoted sufficient resources to counter that meddling, which varied from country to country. They focused on the countries with the weakest systems to resist that meddling. But at the end of the day, I think from an overall perspective, we managed to carry out a free and fair election without too much meddling from the Russian side. One of the initiatives we took from the Transatlantic Commission was to launch a so-called election pledge for election integrity as a kind of a golden standard for elections in the digital age. It was a pledge that was signed by political parties and candidates to fulfill certain criteria. The pledge includes a number of commitments, for instance, that you will not use data that has been falsified or stolen. You will not spread doctored pictures, such as deep fakes, being you have to be transparent if automated accounts are used to spread messages, and you're transparent about your campaign financing. So at the end of the day, the pledge was signed by 180 signatories coming from 21 EU member states and seven political groups of European Parliament, including all the lead candidates, the so-called Spitzenkandidaten. So I think at the end of the day, it was a great success. Of course, it's not legally binding, but I think it's a bit controversial if you refuse to sign this election pledge.
I think all the things in that pledge are very sound or sensible policies. I mean, in America, Michael, I remember being in Washington in early 2018. I had a meeting with people in the intelligence community who said that the tech companies know that 2018 midterms, they can't allow any Russian interference, they can't allow any interference on social media. I mean, do you think they have been successful in doing all that they need to do to stop foreign interference in American politics?
I think we've made progress, but of course it's been complicated. So the most obvious forms of interference, which involve impersonating American citizens, you know, by people sitting in St. Petersburg, or botnets that affect algorithms, I think a lot of that has been corrected. A lot of the sites have been taken down. There's an increasing capability to spot artificially manipulated search results and take those out. But part of what's happened is the adversaries have adjusted to that. In many cases, what they're doing is they are using Americans to become the mouthpiece for the manipulation. And they may amplify a message, but the message may originate from Americans who have extreme ideologies or supporting a particular candidate. And they may use Americans' accounts, legitimate accounts, to propagate things. That creates a challenge for the social media companies because they don't want to be accused of censoring. But at the same time, they recognize that this is simply a thinly veiled effort to continue with this foreign interference. But I always have to say, Damien, to be completely candid, much of the worst disinformation we've had in the 2020 election was domestically generated. Frankly, the Russians could just sit back and watch while we generated false stories and accusations coming from the very top of the U.S. government. And we're continuing to see that now with these, you know, preposterous postings about widespread fraud in mail-in ballots and at the same time, supposed widespread fraud in the voting machines. And all of this is generated by American citizens, including the President of the United States. And so what we're seeing now is an adaptation of this problem to a much more legally complicated setting where we have to decide, how do you counteract deliberate misinformation that is generated and amplified domestically?
I think that's right. I mean, the Russians don't need to start the fire. They just need to fan the flames.
Correct.
And that's what we're seeing. I mean, how do you feel I suppose the first point should be people in politics, senior people, should take more responsibility for what they say and not allow baseless rumors to spread. But if they don't do that, and we've seen President Trump has not done that, what should the tech companies do? Do you think what they've done has been effective in sort of marking postings as being questionable? Do you think they should go further than that?
I think it's an interesting question. I think marking in the posting helps, but it doesn't really address the problem of people who are being kind of drawn into what we call the rabbit hole by inflammatory material that they just can't resist. And I mean, if you look at the media in general, not just social media, one of the things the media has learned over the years is the way you get people to watch is you stimulate anger, fear, or hate. And so appealing to raw emotion is something which is a device for getting people more deeply engaged. And of course, engagement has commercial value as well as political value. So I think the issue here may be the algorithms in social media and beginning to adjust the algorithms, at least as it relates to political speech, so that when you click on something, what is recommended to you is not a more intense version of the same thing, but either nothing or something that is much more evenly balanced. That's not a perfect cure, but what it does is it makes it more difficult to lure people into a kind of an echo chamber of extremism, which has been something we've seen not only with electoral disinformation, but frankly, terrorist recruiting has used the same technique.
So I think, Anders, we've seen many of these problems in Europe as well. And there's a growing debate in Europe, I'd say particularly in the UK, now around updating our electoral law to make them sort of fit for the digital age. So the rules that apply to what you can do offline apply online as well, around the transparency of campaigning, understand who the real people are, where the money comes from. But it also suggests that there need to be some standards we expect the tech companies to hold. And therefore, it begs the question as to whether there should be some sort of regulatory framework which sets standards for the tech companies and how they should act. And I'd be interested in your views on that and yours too, Michael.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult question, actually, because on the one hand, we should do more to counter disinformation, fake news, etc. But on the other hand, we also have a precious principle of free speech. And how to strike that balance, that will always be a real challenge. I'm not sure that legislation alone will do the job. But let me use an example. We are partnering with a private company called NewsGuard. NewsGuard is a company consisting of journalists and other media specialists who are watching what is published in different media throughout the day. And they warn users when they view content from what they consider fake news. The analysis is designed to be transparent. They rank media according to 9 criteria, and if you fulfill those criteria, you get a green mark. If you do not, you get a red mark. And then it's for the readers and the listeners and the viewers to make their own judgment. Of course, it's not a perfect solution, but I do believe that it is one instrument that could be used to stimulate the critical approach to the news you're confronted with.
I suppose there's the question I think that Michael, you alluded to as well, about amplification by the platform. So it's not just about misleading content on there, but whether the misleading content is amplified to a greater extent than the reliable information. So people predominantly see misleading information and on balance think, well, that's all anyone seems to be talking about, so there's probably something in it. And do you think in that aspect that there needs to be some standards that we ask the tech companies to work to, that they don't, whilst they may allow people to post their opinions, they don't allow their tools to be used to amplify those opinions just because they're engaging?
I do think so. I think that, you know, unlike content, which at least in the US is, you know, kind of very strongly protected by our free speech rules, I'm not sure that amplification gets the same level of protection. And often amplification is done by taking an element of a story and putting it out front in a way that attracts attention because it's inflammatory in some way. So that may be something where I do think putting some standards in, at least as it relates to political topics, might be sensible. Likewise with hate speech. Or for example, as we have a vaccine hopefully approaching on COVID, stories that would amplify the idea that vaccine will kill you, vaccine is tainted, are precisely the kinds of things that ought not to be amplified. So I do think we're going to need to take a serious look at amplification and similar algorithmic forms of manipulation as an area that we might impose some standards on.
Anders, earlier on in our conversation, you mentioned that the idea for the Transatlantic Commission came from an article written by Joe Biden and a call you had with him. I was very interested during the presidential campaign that Joe Biden was quite outspoken about social media, Facebook in particular, and saying that they shouldn't allow people to spread disinformation through their ad tools, and that they should do more to combat disinformation. And people in Joe Biden's campaign have been very critical of Facebook's slow response to the Stop the Steal campaign, suggesting mass fraud in the election. How do you think the president-elect's incoming administration might start to address some of these issues?
Well, maybe Michael is better equipped to answer that question in detail. It remains to be seen. But we do know that Joe Biden is very much focused on this. So I have no doubt that during the first 100 days of his presidency, he will present some proposals as to how the big tech companies and big media can contribute to countering disinformation, but which legislation he will present in details, I don't know. But I do know that we can trust him when it comes to a determined effort to solve these problems. But as I mentioned before, it's not easy to strike the right balance between countering disinformation on the one hand and on the other hand ensure free speech.
And right now there's a lot of discussion in the U.S. Congress on the issue of the tech companies. And to be honest, there's a fair amount of hostility. Some of it is that their companies are too big. On the conservative side, there are people who think that the tech companies censor right-wing voices. On the liberal side, there are people who believe the tech companies allow right-wing voices too much amplification. There's discussions about liability protections that the tech companies currently enjoy for content. So I do think that we need to be careful in exactly how we implement change. And one thing I would say is this. I don't know that I would want to see the government in the position of having the final word on, you know, the way tech companies deal with content. Because if you look at the past administration, I don't think that I would have been comfortable having Donald Trump be able to go thumbs up or thumbs down on content, because you can only imagine what the content would have looked like. So, you know, one of the great lessons of the last 4 years, I think, for Americans is that the guardrails that we build in our human rights, sometimes it may seem maybe unnecessarily severe, because we believe that most people are going to, you know, play by the ethical rules anyway. But the last 4 years have shown sometimes you need those guardrails. And so you have to be careful that you don't enlarge the government's power to the point that when you get people who don't respect the norms, you start to have a real problem.
Yeah. I was reading recently about the President Franklin Roosevelt's creation of the Federal Communications Commission. And at a time of radio in the 30s, when it was seen as a very powerful media, and recognizing that you wanted to make sure that different political voices had equal access to it, that there wasn't too much foreign ownership or monopoly ownership. They weren't seeking to regulate speech, but they recognized this was a very powerful new media, and there should be some rules of the road to make sure that power wasn't abused. And to me, it seems like we need something similar for the tech world now.
Well, we had, you know, in the U.S. until cable television dramatically expanded, there was something called the Fairness Doctrine. If you were a broadcaster and there were only a relatively small number of television networks, you had an obligation to air both, different sides of an issue with relative degree of equality, and there were other standards in place. Now, when cable television expanded, that doctrine was abolished because people said, well, there's so many different outlets, people will always get hurt. But I don't think what they anticipated was the use of artificial intelligence, information gathering, and algorithms as a way of so focusing and concentrating messages that that itself would have a distorting effect on the way messages were received. You know, you can, you know, literally speak out of both sides of your mouth now, because you can tell one targeted group one thing, another targeted group the opposite, and both sides won't understand. They've only been getting half the story. So again, that's another issue we need to look at carefully.
Yeah. Anders, in Europe, I mean, there's been a lot of work done by the governments in France and Germany on this, and by the European Commission and institutions. Do you think there will be moves to establish new regulations around social media content in Europe?
Yes, I think we will see a new legislation. But again, I consider this a major problem and a real challenge. I belong to the camp that is also cautioning against too much legislation. I fully agree with Michael Chertoff that it would be a dangerous path to hand over more competences to the government in that respect. That would really politicize the flow of news. Of course, there are certain issues where you objectively is able to conclude that this is fake. But you also have other issues where it's not that obvious. And if the government gets the responsibility to decide, then I think we risk a restriction in free speech that I would not be prepared to accept. So I think we will see new legislation, but I would caution against too much legislation. I think the private sector, the big tech companies should take care of those issues themselves.
I'm very pleased that we're joined again by Charles Creel on the podcast. Charles is a bit of a transatlantic week himself, but his feet are now firmly back on the European side of the ocean. What's caught your attention in the last few days, Charles?
Well, it's interesting watching the aftermath of the election in the United States, and hoping rather that it's an aftermath of the election. But disinformation still going out in some states where the message has come from the very top that in fact the vote is disputed when it's not. But what's really interested me in listening to this conversation, Damien, I've just had a couple of questions that have come up that I'm curious about for both Michael and Anders. You've both said that before 2016, we weren't really aware of this problem or the severity of the problem. And I'm wondering, that kind of falls in that category of unknown unknowns. And it makes me wonder if there isn't something that we're not aware of now that we should be very concerned about. How can we look toward the future, and what kind of interference might be coming in elections?
Well, I can begin. So first of all, I would say even prior to 2016, we knew that there were information operations mounted by the Russians and influence operations, and this has been going on for decades. I just think that there was a period of time, after the fall of the Soviet Union, that we just discounted the degree to which this could be a threat to the unity of effort, both among Western countries and even within Western countries. So it wasn't so much that it was an unknown issue, it was an underappreciated issue. I think that actually the thing we're seeing now, which is troubling and I think will be part of what we need to continue to look at, is we've been thinking about election integrity as protecting against efforts to affect the vote before the vote is cast. with propaganda or undermining people's willingness to actually go to the polls. What we're now seeing is, after the election, efforts to attack the integrity of the election and to attack the legitimacy of the elected officials. And that is something which is not going to end, and it hasn't ended, with the tallying of the votes, but it may continue for a considerable period of time as part of a general effort on the part of our adversaries overseas to erode the confidence and belief in institutions, which are the foundation of democracy. You know, one of the things the commission heard yesterday in a discussion with people who've been monitoring the election in Taiwan is that the Chinese Communist Party on the mainland focuses a lot of disinformation efforts at telling Taiwanese and other international actors that democracy doesn't work, it's inefficient, it's corrupt, and that only a top-down authoritarian managed government really can deliver for the people. This is not a message that is only going to be geared to the electoral cycle, but it's going to be an effort to undermine our democracy on an ongoing basis.
I agree with Michael. Let me just add to this. I think we will see further development of technology. I think what we call deep fake technology will be further advanced. A couple of years ago, we produced a so-called deep fake video with President Trump. And we showed him in three editions, a true Trump, a Trump where an actor pretended to speak like Trump, and thirdly, a machine that spoke like Trump. And then we presented it to an audience, and it was not possible for people to distinguish. They couldn't decide who was the true Trump and who wasn't. Since then, the technology has been further developed, and we do know that if people are watching a video, it looks much more credible than if they're just presented with some information. And I think in that respect, we will see a further step that will require further action from our side.
You're talking about the post-Soviet era and the end of the Cold War as being a moment when the way we looked at these things shifted. And indeed, historically, we might have been looking to our security services to monitor these kinds of things, foreign election interference, massive propaganda, fake media with presidential figures, and so on. Why are we now relying on big tech for this? Can we not rely on security services?
I think security services can be of value, but again, I think sometimes they get swept up in some of the skepticism and even cynicism that we see, permeating Western democracies and leading to a loss of trust. And by the way, Exhibit A is Donald Trump, who has consistently rejected the warnings of his own security services and said that they're part of the deep state. So I do think, in a funny way, a public-private partnership has more credibility than a purely government effort.
Yeah, okay. I agree. But of course, there will be issues that can be dealt with security services in the most efficient way, of course. But I do believe that private, public partnership or cooperation here is the right way forward. And to a large degree, we will have to base ourselves and the actions on what we could self-responsibility among the private actors.
And just one more question from me. What do we do with a situation like Parler, which has been set up very specifically to be partisan? It's been invested in early on by the Mercers. It seems like we're not going to get a lot of cooperation there in having a balanced dialogue within it. And the reaction we might get from them might be very different than, say, from a Facebook, even though that's not ideal, or a Twitter. What do you all think about that?
Let me try this. So I recognize and this has always been true, you will always get fringe media that are very focused on a particular ideology and have a narrow band of people who watch it. That's been a feature of free speech and communication for as long as history records it. What I think is important is the people who sign on to that have already made a decision about how they want to curate their news. They only want to hear things that subscribe to their point of view. That's true with some of the cable television we have in the US. What I think is important is to differentiate between that and broad-based platforms that purport to be welcoming to a large population, but then can be manipulated or will manipulate in order to drive people who sign on into a particular slot or a particular rabbit hole. So to me, if we can differentiate between broad-based media that holds itself open to everybody and have them abide by certain standards, we accept the fact that people who are already deeply invested in a particular ideological viewpoint will find alternative media sources. But again, they won't scale. They'll be relatively narrow and their impact will be relatively small. Now, I should hasten to add, even for them, there are limits. Incitement to violence, for example, is illegal, whether it's a broad-based platform or a narrow platform. Child pornography is illegal. But it's a different set of standards, I think, that apply in that instance.
If I could just come in with just a final question for me. I mean, the Transatlantic Commission was set up to look at election interference, and we'd probably say that as democracies, interference in elections is one of the most serious sort of communication challenges we could face. But we've got a different challenge coming up now, which is not party political, but important to the world. And that's the delivery of the COVID vaccine. And I think sometimes with politics, people hold their own political beliefs. They might say, well, I would never be persuaded of, sort of a different opinion just because I've seen something on Facebook. But I think what we've seen this year is that people can be led to believe medical conspiracy theories around something new like COVID that can influence the way they behave. And it's going to be very important for the world now that we've almost got these vaccines ready to be deployed, that people have confidence in them. And this would seem to be a moment for the tech companies to demonstrate the social responsibility they can take to make sure that the vaccine program isn't undermined by disinformation. And I'd welcome any thoughts you have on that before we close.
Yeah, I fully agree. That is, of course, essential, but it's very much for the medical companies to get their message through. Still, I think it should be voluntary if people want to be vaccinated. Whether they believe or not believe, the medical companies sets up for them. But gradually we can reopen societies, and if people are willing to run the risk not to be vaccinated, it's their case and their responsibility. So I agree that also in this case we should counter disinformation, but at the end of the day, it is a private responsibility.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Michael?
No, I agree, although I will say that the platforms have indicated that they will take down, you know, obviously false statements. Mm-hmm. But I think that to the extent that, you know, it's a question of evaluating personal risk, I agree with Anders. In the end, people have to judge for themselves, bearing in mind that if you're not vaccinated, that may impose additional travel restrictions or restrictions on, for example, your ability to go to work. That you're going to have to consider as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, Michael Chertoff, thank you both so much for joining us on the podcast. It's been great to talk to you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Infotagent podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Anders Fogh Rasmussen, Michael Chertoff, and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagent, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagent.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can also support this show by becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/InfoTagenPodcast. InfoTagen is a not-for-profit organization, and all the proceeds will go towards the making of this podcast. Thank you. Until next time.